Good morning, Nexus. Thank you, Shelley. Good morning, Nexus. All right, okay. So the day has come. This is my very first sermon ever, and I'm really glad that we get to do this together. Will you pray with me? God, we thank you for your presence and your love. We rest in it. Okay, so I have a very important question for you. Is there a condiment or condiments you could not live without? I want you to consider carefully just for a moment. Take your time. Think it over. I'd love to get a show of hands. You can vote for more than one. Who thinks mayonnaise is a necessity? Okay, yeah, got some. Yeah, okay, thank you. Ketchup? Ooh, a little higher, I think. Salt, and like special salts, all the salts. Fleur de sel, all the, okay. Mustard? Mm-hmm. Guacamole? Ooh, okay. Salsa? Feel in love. Sriracha. Yes. Soy sauce. Okay. Oil, all the special oils, hot oil, spicy oil, garlic oil, ranch dips and all of that kind of stuff. Oh boy, okay. Relish. Are there homemade relish makers here? Okay. Hot sauce. Okay, few, brave few. Anything else we need to acknowledge? Lemon? Butter. Yeah, okay. Where? Good one. Anything else? Garlic? Yeah. Okay. Very good. Okay, so I was curious about what Canada overall would say. I think here it was ketchup, possibly. Salt was pretty high. Mayo, maybe. Overall, anybody want to guess? Yeah. It was salsa, actually. And mayonnaise was a close second, so it's probably all those tuna sandwiches Brad's making at home. Now, France showed a love for mustard, along with aioli, which is like mayonnaise, and salt. So France is pretty famous for mustard, right? And it's fundamental to French cuisine. Every French person a year buys a kilogram of mustard. But this year there's a mustard shortage in France, and it's our fault. Well, actually it's climate change, but it feels Canadian to say sorry. But we are the world's largest exporter of mustard seeds, and France is the second largest importer of mustard seeds, even though they're so well known for their Dijon mustard. But Dijon mustard is made primarily of Canadian mustard seeds, which ended up being a real problem this year with the droughts in the prairies. So when we were over there in France this summer, I actually even overheard an older woman asking a grocery store clerk if any mustard had come in, and the answer was non, toujours pas. Such a tiny thing, a mustard seed, and France is feeling the loss. So I'm thinking Jesus' favorite condiment was mustard, because he sure talks about mustard seeds a lot. Once in our passage today, that Christy read. In our planning, Brad mentioned it might be nice to kind of work the gospel reading into my sermon, maybe add a little soupçon here and there, but I got really drawn into it, so I went right into it. I think there's some good stuff here in the words of Jesus and some really curious things, too. So let's just look at it again now that we know we're going to really be dealing with it. When a servant comes in from, I'm skipping ahead here. The Lord answered, no, even further. The apostles said to the Lord, show us how to increase our faith. And in some translations, it just says, increase our faith. The Lord answered, if you had faith even as small as a mustard seed, you could say, to this mulberry tree may you be uprooted and be planted in the sea, and it would obey you. When a servant comes in from plowing or taking care of sheep, does his master say, come in and eat with me? No, he says, prepare my meal, put on your apron, and serve me while I eat. Then you can eat later. And does the master thank the servant for doing what he was told to do? Of course not. In the same way, when you obey me, you should say, we're unworthy servants who have simply done our duty. To me, Jesus' meaning is not immediately obvious, but some questions formed for me that I thought we could explore together. So for us travelers on the Jesus path, first of all, we might wonder, what does this passage invite us or challenge us to do? Question two, how do we do that? And then how do we know we're doing it? There are three big questions. Let's see what we can notice. And we might find some answers even, but most exciting for me would be for you to walk away with some really good questions that you can journey with, questions that apply to you and your journey. So number one, what are we invited to do? Well, Jesus tells the disciples they can make trees fly just by speaking to them. Anyone done that? Nope. Well, I was going to say I didn't even really want to try, but actually I realized that's not quite true. Our house in the heart of a little French village had stinging nettle growing thick and wild right where our little girls needed to pass to school every day. So I spent that first August in the dirt, literally wrestling with those very stubborn roots. And I won, but that battle was tough. If you could have seen me, you would have been laughing probably at the spectacle I made. I recall frequently losing my grip on a root, or a root letting go unexpectedly and me falling back into the dirt and the rest of the stinging nettle plants. It was hot, sweaty, dirty, and stingy. I know that I would have loved to have you come and offer to rip them out by speaking a word. So this strange image of a tree flying through the air and being planted in the sea, there's something maybe appealing about it. It's maybe impressive at the very least, maybe also useful because mulberry tree roots can buckle foundations. They're invasive, they're very hard to get rid of. There are all kinds of tips on the internet for how to kill them. You can know that for yourself. Ripping them up and throwing them in the sea would destroy them. Maybe that is something we should try to do, like maybe rip out the bad root systems in our hearts. But there's something mysterious here because when they ask for more faith, Jesus responds with irritation. Rachel Held Evans says the Greek suggests a bit of snark. He jokes sarcastically using the objects around him to make his point. So I'm kind of imagining it as like, oh goodness, guys, if you had faith the size of a mustard seed, you could speak to this mulberry tree and it would plant itself in the ocean. Wouldn't that be great? What is he saying here? To answer that, we need to back up and look at why the disciples ask for more faith. So in verses 3 and 4, Jesus challenges them to rebuke someone who offends them and forgive them, even if they do it 7 times in a day. So I just want to point out, rebuke and then forgive. Rebuke, I think, we don't rebuke, do you rebuke often? I think it's actually having hard conversations and speaking your truth. Say what you want to say. But that's tough, the rebuking and the forgiving. So the disciples immediately reply, increase our faith. And I kind of wonder how earnest that was. Like, were they serious or was it kind of like a have mercy moment? In any case, this request is often viewed as a positive model we need to follow. But that sarcastic response from Jesus may give us some pause and maybe pique our curiosity. And then there's more curious stuff in that last section, which I think is a clue to Jesus' frustration and his point, perhaps. There's this image of a master and a servant, which Jesus flips one way and then the other. First, he asks, does a master invite the servant to eat and rest before serving the master dinner? No, a servant should do what's asked, serve the master when they're tired, without congratulating themselves. And likewise, we should consider ourselves unworthy when we only do what's asked of us. So time out for all of us who struggle with feeling like we're not enough. Before we dive into that all too familiar guilt, let's just think about how Jesus usually deals with hierarchies. Rachel Held Evans points out that Jesus doesn't tend to speak unkindly about slaves or those of lower status, but rather turns hierarchies and power structures on their head. Jesus is harshest with the proud, using biting satire for those who need to be shocked into a little self-awareness and humility and compassion. She says, from the beginning, Jesus' ministry was about lifting up the humble and humbling the proud, of challenging those in authority and giving voice to the marginalized, so it's safe to assume that there must have been an element of pride or entitlement at work in the disciples' request to warrant this sort of response. So in this passage, Jesus seems to be leaning into the conventional social structures to make his point, exposing the disciples' true motivation. Under this pious request for more faith lurks some less helpful stuff, some pride, the desire to impress, some entitlement, as well as their resistance to this idea of radical forgiveness. It seems like they're not really aware of what's going on in their hearts, hence the lesson. Maybe when they hear the challenge to forgive, they just notice this inner, yeah, I don't want to do that. So they stop there, assume they don't have what they need, and they ask Jesus to do it for them by giving them more faith. Jesus pushes it back to them. The problem is not your lack of faith. You only need a little bit, like a mustard seed. So good thing it's not a literal mustard seed because there's a shortage. We need faith like a mustard seed. And that's good news because a mustard seed is small and accessible and grows through a natural process that we don't need to make happen. We can't make it happen, and we can't even rush it, although we can facilitate the growth process. But that also means that mustard seed faith is maybe more ordinary, plain, more surprising, less spectacular than we might like. We might need patience to facilitate and wait on that growth process. We might need to do things parts of us would rather not do. Janet Hagberg says, faith is a verb, which just means letting God direct our lives. So we faith as we open our lives to God to guide us and try to live out what we hear. But letting God direct our lives is tricky business. So getting to the point where we're willing to follow is difficult, and even when we're there, we can easily get bogged down in the how. It's difficult to trust God. For some of us more than others, but we've all prayed for things that haven't happened. We struggle to know what we can count on God for. And then there's the question of how we receive directions. We can struggle to hear clearly and then to trust what we hear. And humans are pretty good at coming to the wrong conclusions for so many amazing reasons. But one of them, I think, is because we focus on the wrong things. It's very easy to focus on our lack of faith, our lack of willingness, our lack of love, energy. And that's what the disciples did. Forgive. Gonna need more faith for that. Jesus is saying, look, you already have what you need. The hard part is wanting to do it. Kierkegaard wrote, it is hard to believe, not because it's hard to understand, but because it is hard to obey. It is hard to faith. So if an answer to question one, what are we invited to do, is we faith, with faith like a mustard seed, we come to question two, how do we do that? And I think Jesus offers us a how with that object lesson of the master and the servant. Just like the disciples who don't want to forgive, I imagine that a servant doesn't much feel like making the master's meal after working all day. They would also likely notice that big inner, yeah, I don't want to. So while the servant-master dynamic was more familiar in Jesus' day, I have a different situation that springs to mind when I think about I don't want to. Children. We know the drill. All we need to say is, okay, sweetie, time to go home. And we will likely hear, no, I don't want to. Maybe. We all know that I don't want to is not the end of the story, though, right? We can't let it end there. We're all going home one way or another. We're asking, as parents, for something so simple and straightforward, and yet the will of this little person seems insurmountable. All they have to do is get up and follow us out, or be carried, whatever. We can do this however you want, but that's the last thing they want to do. So since we're the adult here, we take a deep breath, and we join them in gentleness. We see things from their perspective. What do you got there? What are you doing? We enjoy their world with them for a little bit, and when they feel seen and met, and they can tell if we're just playing them, they'll be more willing to make the shift. That's the idea anyway. No guarantees, but it might work. What doesn't work is trying our skills of superior logic or power. And please note, this is hard-won wisdom for me. I do recall one time lobbing a tiny shoe out our open front door during a particularly epic battle to get a wee foot into that shoe. The wee foot didn't want to. In the end, patience won the day, and we did manage to leave the house. So we don't let it end with "I don't want to" with our children, but with our inner lives, we do, don't we? I do, quite regularly. Yeah, I don't want to think about that. I don't want to reach out to them. I don't want to forgive her. No, don't want to. Or it could be something like we're asked to serve on a committee or drive someone to the airport or coach a soccer team and we notice ourselves stalling to reply to the email. We can't figure out why. We can't seem to write back. Or maybe we notice that inner "I don't want to" pretty clearly. And let's be clear, there's nothing wrong with that "I don't want to." Like our child, our soul has a very good reason. When I say soul, I mean like all of our inner being, our thoughts, will, emotions, motivations, memories. It's the non-physical part of who we are. So when we notice our soul saying, "I don't want to," we have a few options, some of which do not serve us very well at all. We might judge it right away and just decide we're a terrible person for not wanting to help our friend. That's a quick downward spiral I know well. Another strategy is to say, "Well, I don't want to, so I guess that's that." And we don't give it a second thought. Either way, I think that's a dead end because it's running away. Have we considered that maybe that "I don't want to" is trying to help us or protect us? Aren't we a little curious? Don't we want to know what that's connected to? When we run either into self-condemnation or avoidance, we won't hear that God may not be even asking us to do that thing. And this is revolutionary for those of us who were taught you could discern what God's will was because it was the thing that was hard and that you didn't want to do. But maybe when we listen a minute, we'll actually feel empowered to say no to that thing so we can say yes to things we are called to do. And maybe when we listen, we'll notice our very valid concerns. Then our fear will feel reassured that we're listening, and it will relax a little bit, and we'll feel released to say yes to that thing. But when we stop dead at the "I don't want to," we miss out on the freedom that comes either way from ending the war with ourselves. So what if we try the gentleness and curiosity approach with our souls? "Oh, hey, I hear you don't want to sign up for that thing. What's that about? What's your concern there? What might you be afraid of happening?" Or even deeper, "Hello, my soul. I see you're really comfortable in this place of anger. It feels safer here, doesn't it? Yeah, I get it. There are a lot of good reasons to hold on to it. You've been hurt. And there's some grief here too, isn't there? Yeah. And also, it seems these old ways aren't working so well. I notice you're beginning to feel some discomfort with your grip on that old story. Should we just let it loosen a little?" What if we approach our souls like our children? We get alongside with curiosity and wonder, love and gentleness, understanding and firmness, and we respond to the shift that is being asked of us. Whether it's by the schedule of the day, by the Spirit, by the Jesus path, we acknowledge where we are, what's going on, and we take the next step. What if Jesus is saying, "Stop lusting after flashy signs and wonders to impress and wow, and stop avoiding what I'm actually calling you to do. Don't wait until you feel like it. Go use what you've got. Dare to try to do the truly big, difficult things like forgiveness. You have a little faith already, and it's enough to do what needs to be done." Here in our passage of Luke, Jesus' focus is less on the amount of their faith and more on the very human reason they're asking for more of it. He's gently revealing their desire to impress and wanting that easy fix. Plot twist. In Matthew, He also talks about the mustard seed of faith, but this time he just digs into their lack of faith. This time he's not joking around. This time he's really, really frustrated. They ask him why they weren't able to cast out a demon, and he says, because of the littleness of your faith. If you had just a little, you could move a mountain and nothing would be impossible for you. This time he seems to say they don't even have a little bit, and he's kind of upset about that. So where does that leave us? Do we have the faith we need or don't we? It seems that Jesus is saying both. You have it and you don't. So maybe the paradox here is like putting your glasses on top of your head and forgetting them. Technically, you have your glasses, but do you? And you actually need your glasses to find your glasses. So you ask for help and someone says, and you say, oh, look, they were with me all the time. We have enough faith, and yet we don't. And we even need a little faith to find the faith we have. So how does that work? How do we get that faith or access the faith we have, whatever? Well, I think we faith by faithing. Letting God direct our lives. Letting ourselves be formed, which is actually just freeing what we already are. I love that image that Brad offered a few weeks back, maybe last spring, I think. We are sculptures under construction. The sculptor removes in order to reveal what is hidden inside the marble. We have what we need. We bear God's image. Now the work is this mysterious subtraction process. Maybe there are some roots that need to be removed. Maybe that mountain does need to move. Maybe that mountain is inside me. What if Jesus is saying we can actually do all the things we're called to do? Pray, forgive, participate with God in the reconciling of all things, get our toddler to come home with us. We can do those things when we let God direct our lives. And that doesn't mean there won't be blood, sweat, and tears. We might have to make some tough decisions about how we spend our resources. Is that me? Do not disturb. Here we go. As I was saying, we might have to make some tough decisions. We won't always be able to wow the people or please the people, but maybe we can do all the things we're called to do. Because we do, we faith as we be who we are, children of God, citizens of the kingdom of God. As beloved image bearers, our true selves are aligned with God. The deepest part of me knows I am loved and valuable just for breathing, that knows I belong to God and am connected and resourced. That part is aligned with God and thus does the will of God who is love. That part loves well. That part forgives, is available to others, and maybe even moves mountains because it's aligned with God's love. So how does this freeing of what we already are actually happen? The Bible offers us another paradox. It indicates that a changed heart is both entirely the work of God and dependent on us. There are verses on both sides, and the paradox is actually contained in one sentence in Philippians 2. Work out your salvation with fear and trembling, which sounds like it's our job. For it is God who works in you to will and to act according to his good purpose. Growth is God's job. So the resolution to the paradox is both and. God changes us, and we place our hearts before God to be changed. There is hard work involved for us. It takes doing things we don't want to do. It takes facing our fear and our hurt. And yet, there's also something very simple and accessible about it. And I think former Archbishop Rowan Williams describes this simple, accessible aspect of faith really well when he talks about prayer. Praying is like sunbathing. It has nothing to do with how you feel or how hard you're trying. You're not going to get a better tan by screwing up your eyes and concentrating. You just have to be there where the light can get at you. So how do we do it? We don't force it. And we don't stop at the first sign of an I don't want to either. We don't get so daunted or impressed with ourselves for forgiving or even trying to forgive. And we don't get distracted trying to do unnecessary, spectacular, impressive things either. We give ourselves to the slow journey of trust and reliance and doing the next right thing even when we don't want to, rather than waiting for the epic and showy thing or the deeply satisfying removal of the whole problem at once. We notice the glasses on top of our head and we put them on our eyes where we can use them. We find our faith and use it by remembering who we are, aligning with God, and abiding in love. And that brings us to our third question. How do we know we're doing it? Like, are we faithing well? Richard Rohr says, faith is trusting that an intrinsic union exists between us and God. Contemplative prayer, that's that long, loving look at the real, is to experience this union. The path of fall and return is how we experience this union as pure grace and free gift. So it isn't trying harder. It isn't being perfect. It isn't doing big, impressive things. How do we know we have faith? I think it's a circle. We notice we might need to forgive. We'll ask for more faith. We'll remember who we are and that we have what we need. We'll align our wills as best as we can, our hearts, our actions, aligned with God. We'll abide. We'll forgive. We'll forget. We'll try again. We'll slowly shift from trying to be nice to where we can actually find ourselves becoming more loving people who genuinely care about what God cares about. So we notice and trust God's natural growth process within us, and we cooperate with God's Spirit as well as we can with what we were given. That's it. What if no matter where we are on our journey with faith and doubt and forgiveness and loving and aligning, what if we all need to hear the same message? What you got there? And what if we go with what we have, no matter how small? And we just bring that. We let God breathe life into it. We loosen our grip on the outcome and let God do what God will do. Why not? Feels risky, right? What if it doesn't work? What if it does? Faith is letting God in, and we start where we are. If we can't say, yes, Lord, we say, well, I do want to say yes. If not that, we say, I want to say yes. And Jesus says, great, bring that. To close this morning, I invite you to join me in praying this prayer as an act of faith. If you notice an inner I don't want to, can you be gentle and curious with that part of you? It just might be this part that Henry Nouwen talks about. A part of you was left behind very early in your life, the part that never felt completely received. It's full of fears. Meanwhile, you grew up with many survival skills, but you want yourself to be one. So pray with me as much as you can. Jesus, I want to follow you, or at least I'd like to want to. May my will be aligned with yours. May I find my life in yours. May you love me into loving. I recognize and acknowledge that I'm not here on earth to follow my own way, to seek my own personal fulfillment or glory, to indulge my desires, gather more stuff, impress people, be popular, be somebody important. Deep inside me, I know being relevant or successful by or impressive by human standards is not the goal of my life. I'm here to grow in and into love. So I offer myself back to you. I came from you, and I choose to be found in you. My life and breath and being comes from you. I am yours because you made me and sustain my life. All that I am and all that I have, I give to you. I give you any rebellion in me that resists aligning with you. I give you my pride and self-dependence that tells me I can do your will in my own power if I try hard enough. I give you my fear that tells me I'll never be able to have freedom in some areas of my life. I consent to let you work in me, to create within me, step by step, both the desire and the power to walk your path. I give you my body, all its parts, the weak and the strong. I give you my entire inner being, my mind, my emotional life, my will. I give you my loved ones, my relationships and desires for relationships, my loneliness and my busyness. I give you my abilities and gifts, my strengths and weaknesses, my health, my status, my possessions, my past, my present, my future. May my will be aligned with yours. May I find my life in yours. May you love through me. Amen. So Dave's going to come up, and we'll just take a moment here. Just let kind of things sink in. Maybe let some questions form. And just allow them to mingle with your thoughts.